the abuses which economists may perpetrate, or what you, the abuses you think they may perpetrate, and also I want to talk about the uses to which we put economists. I think there is a tendency, as I indicated yesterday, to elevate economists into technical experts who have some kind of mystical, arcane knowledge denied to the rest of society. I'll get into that a little bit more. I think that's gotten us into some problems recently. That's a use to which they're put, and which I think to which they should not be put. John Maynard Keynes once suggested that it would be a fine thing if economists came to be thought of as simple, ordinary folk like dentists who could perform useful services, but were not magicians. And the other thing is economists maybe do practice certain abuses. I've got some good friends who think that economists are all not deliberately, kind of unconsciously, lackeys of the capitalist class. And it may well be that there's a certain point of view, characteristic of economists, that excludes some realities from attention. It may be that economists are wearing glasses that cause them to see certain aspects of reality and completely miss the significance of other, more important aspects of reality. I even wrote a little textbook called The Economic Way of Thinking. I think there is an economic way of thinking, a way of thinking characteristic of economists. While I think it's very powerful, I also think it has some serious limitations. Well, so I want you to interrupt me at any time. If I can't stand it, I'll finally tell you to shut up. So I'm talking about what economists know and don't know. Yesterday, we were reflecting on unemployment. What it means. What I was trying to persuade you of basically is that unemployment today in the American economy is very much a product of choice, which doesn't mean that people can choose anything they want, but people are choosing. In other words, our unemployment levels and the particular incidence of unemployment, who's unemployed or counted as unemployed, depends upon the values that people are currently holding and the priorities that they pursue, and in changing and sometimes rapidly changing social circumstances. If this is true, I think it is undeniable. I mean, he analyzes the unemployment phenomenon and comes to the conclusion that it is true. Then we are being very, very badly served by the popular notion that unemployment is a consequence of simply an inadequate level of total spending. And that's a very popular notion, that if the unemployment rate is at 7% or 7.5%, then the economy isn't turning over fast enough. You know, we're not, GNP isn't running at a high enough rate, and that's because people aren't spending enough. So what we got to do is stimulate the economy. That notion, which grew out of the Great Depression, where it was it had a great deal of relevance and truth, I think serves us very, very badly today. And how tragic it would be if we kind of reluctantly agreed to stimulate total spending by households and businesses and government, even what we almost all would concede to be wasteful spending. We agreed to do that and pursued policies to do that, which would consume scarce and non-renewable resources even faster, and pollute the atmosphere and the environment even faster. If we did this, not because we really wanted the goods, but because we thought it was necessary to do this in order to maintain full employment, when in fact that wouldn't get us any closer to full employment. I really worry very much that the economic growth debate is being badly polluted by the myth that we need economic growth in order to get all Americans employed. Because while there are correlations between growth rates and employment, they're very, very loose correlations. And it's, again, the roast pig example. Stimulating gross national product in order to get the unemployment level down is a lot like barbecuing pig by putting the pigs on the first floor and burning down the house.
Well, If those 7% of people that weren't employed were employed, wouldn't that stimulate economic growth? Wouldn't the economic growth be larger because you had 7% of the people working?
Well, it depends. Yeah, well, it would be a little bit. Yeah, I mean, if you put if you put a million more people to work, you'll presumably get some additional output, yeah. But that's, now that's not what I was, okay, that's true, is that all? That's not what I was focusing on. What I was worried about was that we would continually be stimulating, you know, we would provide investment tax credits to business firms, and we would cut consumer taxes while maintaining high levels of government spending in order to, you know, provide incentives to business firms to hire more people and produce more goods. And that, I'm saying, is perverse.
Paul, isn't this GNP the same thing as talking about unemployment? It's another catch phrase used by economists that are being promoted and are really detrimental, but they're essentially, they're probably being encouraged by people who are profit motivated, who are saying, keep telling the people that you have to increase the gross national product to be a success, just like you can't, you're having trouble changing, instead of saying unemployment, saying what is the rate of employment type of thing. Isn't this, again, these phrases that keep being used to promote something that has nothing to do with your business, but has to do with another person's business who is trying to make a profit out of us, exploit us in a sense.
Yeah, your question is your question.
Cynical.
Are you your question basically, is the concept of gross national product really good for anything, or is it just an elaborate?
It's a promotional scheme.
You know,
it depends on where you're at in your economic structure. Yeah. I mean, we're at a point now where it's not beneficial to us to increase the gross national product.
I think it would be beneficial to us. Now, this is really I'll make a radical statement, but it's. It might not seem radical to you, but it's nobody admits it in the economics profession, but I've really come to the conclusion it's true. We would be better off if we stopped measuring the gross national product. there are all sorts of conceptual deficiencies in it. And what it nobody knows what it measures. It certainly doesn't measure gross national welfare, and yet a lot of people think it does. Changes in it are treated as a significant barometer of all kinds of things, of which they, in fact, are not significant barometers. And I in a textbook published this year, I did a long section calling attention to the deficiencies of GNP and what it doesn't tell you. And when I got all through, I realized when I'm through telling people what it doesn't tell, there ain't nothing left that it tells. And then I asked, well, what is GNP good for? And as I listed the things that it was good for, I realized that they were mostly trivial. Like, I really think there are two things that GNP, you all know what, you all think you know what it is. It's an artifact. It's something that we treat as if it exists somewhere. You know, it's a pile, it's a mountain someplace. But it's something that's devised by the Bureau of Economic Analysis in the Department of Commerce. But two things it's good for. It is good for journalists who are looking for numbers. Suppose you've got to write on the economic outlook for the New York Times. How do you write on the economic outlook? Well, it's nice to have some numbers that you can throw out. The other thing it's good for, I know, is multiple choice exams.
commenting on his question, if we took the 7.5% and employed them, if it is indeed the case that a large number of these people are unemployed by choice because they are seeking a job that will give them some kind of meaning, you know, and they're not desperate to get money to live on, okay, if in fact we employ those people by somehow providing the jobs that they were seeking, we might not increase productivity levels. But that's a whole different culture.
We might not increase the value of output, but we could well increase the cost of the output. I mean, in other words, we might be producing a lot of things inefficiently. Now, whether that burns up resources we ought not to burn up, I don't know. If we're just burning up human energy, maybe that might be what they need. Those people need something to do. You know, there's a proposal that I do want to mention that has been that the government become the employer of last resort as a way of dealing with the unemployment problem. And I'm sympathetic to that, but only in one of its two versions. And there are two versions. There is a conservative version. Arthur Burns, the current chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, has proposed this, that the way we deal with the unemployment problem is that the government say, Anybody who cannot find a job and wants one can get a job from the government. The government will provide employment, but, says Burns, at a wage just below the legal minimum. A lot of other people, Hubert Humphrey for one, has recommended the same sort of thing, but Humphrey has said at a wage equal to prevailing wage levels. And that's the enormous difference. You see, if it won't work the second way. It would work. The first way would guarantee that everybody who really wants to work could work. Of course, at $2 an hour or so. And you say, well, that's inadequate. Yeah, well, that's inadequate for some people. It's not inadequate for other people. It depends upon your responsibilities. But is there any way that we can guarantee everybody a job at the wage that he wants? I mean, prevailing at for whom, for what? You know, if I'm a college professor, I'm a professor of English, and I can't find a job teaching English, and what's the prevailing wage? Should I now get a job from the government at the prevailing wage for English instructors? Oh, this is going to have that. Problems there would be enormous. The inequities, the injustice, the...
Think of all the books you could write, though. Well, you sit behind that desk doing nothing.
Well, that would be good in my case, but see, there are lots of people who write bad books, Jack.
Before we leave unemployment, I get a very uncomfortable feeling from this that somehow you're lulling us into some sort of acceptance of 20% unemployment in the ghetto in Chicago, and I don't know what unemployment means, but a lot of young people roving the street who can't or are not employed and are really the seedbed for all kinds of disturbance and disintegration.
Yeah, okay, you know, let me just support you so that...
Can I throw in a comment too?
Yeah.
In Oakland, I teach in an all-black school, which is very poor. I go to church in a rich white suburb. And all the high school kids in church have jobs this summer, and almost none of my kids in the inner city do.
That's
who you know.
Right. I want to that unemployment figure of 7.3% in May, and Twiggs says it's 7.5% now, seasonally adjusted. It varies enormously for household heads, male household heads. The current unemployment rate is only 4%. For teenagers, it's 18.5%. For blacks, for whites, it's 6.6%. For blacks, it's 12.2%. For black teenagers, guess. 38.5%. Well, yeah, okay. I hope that having read those figures, now, that's a problem. There's something seriously wrong when the unemployment rate among black teenagers, two out of five are picked up by the BLS as unemployed. But I cannot believe that the solution is to crank the economy up faster.
I'm not saying, I just say that we're waiting.
Yeah. I think what we got to get into here is, you know, we're going to have to look at what's going on in there. I said this is a function of values, priorities, goals, social circumstances in which one finds them. How does a black teenager in Chicago see the world? What is attracting him? What is repelling him? These are important questions. What turns him on? Why does he behave as he does? I think economists have something to contribute to that discussion. I don't think that we should look to economists primarily for an answer here. If we do, we're going to look for magic wand solution. Al, is that?
Yeah, I think the theory of the world that the economists work with is a theory which does not permit us, and not permit us to focus on this kind of issue.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's true, but...
Well, it certainly is not. I mean, it's a kind of global thing, a system thing.
Oh, yeah, okay, let me make a point. The economists do take a kind of a global view, but there are two different global views that economists take. One, I think, is good, and one is bad. One approach, economists one part of the economic way of thinking, or one very, very prominent characteristic of the way economists look at the world, as this is the good economists, is that they see, say, everything's connected to everything else. It's a general equilibrium analysis. They, in fact, that's what economists learn. One of the things that makes them valuable where they are valuable, they learn to recognize that when you do this, it has that consequence, which has this consequence, which has that consequence, which acts back on here, and so what you thought would happen isn't going to happen. This is a general system view. There's another kind of general system view, which is sometimes called aggregative analysis, where economists lump things together, and they start talking about the economy as if the economic system were not a product of individuals buying beans and taking jobs in Arby's roast beef, but as if there were consumers, investors, government, and foreigners. And they create these enormous aggregative categories and try to build mathematical models, or semi-mathematical models, that can predict the economy. And I think that when economists do this, they are particularly likely to be false prophets. I don't think that's what you're saying, Al, but this is...
Well, any science which does not deal with a phenomenon like that 38%, constructively, I'd say, that's something wrong.
But, Al, it does. Now, there's a notion around that lots of people accuse economists of not dealing with important problems like this. There's an enormous literature in economics dealing with, talking about, worrying about, trying to get at the problem of black teenage unemployment. I mentioned Robert Lukacman, his book, Economists at Bay. The book has gotten a lot of attention, and he blasts economists for neglecting all sorts of serious social problems. And I could direct you to the annual proceedings, papers and proceedings of the American Economic Association, and show you at least one paper per year in the papers and proceedings on precisely those issues that Lukacman says economists aren't addressing. And I cite that because that's the official meeting. That's where the economists get together and sort of review what it is that's really preoccupying them.
Paul, aren't you saying, the thing that bothers me on this thing, and going the other direction, is that every time you get into a technical discussion about a certain, and maybe try to give a broad technical discussion on a particular discipline, somebody comes along and says, well, you aren't addressing yourself to that part. And the trouble is that, no, you aren't, because that day you can't do it because the subject is so complex. There's nothing wrong with, if you're going to do a system study, there's nothing wrong with starting with a broad scope and then improving it as you go. Then there is a point in that study where you come to where there's certain things that you should focus on. For instance, this problem of black teenager unemployment. And so what you do is you go out separately and you work on that thing. At least that's been my experience. Now, I've worked in a field where it's highly technical, where there's it's very involved in aircraft and in space type of vehicles, where there is many, many aspects to this thing. And there's no one time when you sit down and talk about the whole thing. When you're a chief engineer and you get credit for doing a job designing a vehicle, man, you're a long ways from that design, really, when you come down to things. Sure, you set up the basics, but there's some fellow down the corner that's one of your staff that's one of 1,000 people, and he's working as diligently on a small element of that thing to make it a success as anything else. And I don't think you can address yourself in a discussion like this to one particular thing, and you don't need to be on the defensive in the sense that the economists aren't thinking about that, but you can't do it and get the overall scope.
Well, yeah, right. I do want you people to raise these kinds of questions.
Yeah,
I hope I'm not being defensive.
You appear to be defensive of saying there's lots of papers and so forth.
No, I'm not. I don't feel defensive. I'm asserting this because I think it's important that you know it. You know, the contention that economists aren't addressing the real pressing social issues of our day is false. It's demonstrably false. They are addressing those issues. They're also addressing other issues. A typical what Lekakman does is he cites the titles of a whole bunch of articles and points out that they're only read by 10 other economists. Nobody else pays. Well, true, but that's not all that economists are doing.
I wasn't addressing the issue of whether you were addressing or not. I was addressing the issue of whether a theory, on the basis of which theory the system functions to result in something like this, raise the real question in my mind about the basic understandings that are involved in the theory.
Yeah, and that's going to get us out too far. Yeah. It's a good thing to talk about, but since I wrote my PhD dissertation under him on that question. We will not discuss it. And he's got another student who's going to do it over again because I did it about 15 years ago and it's now wrong. He's going to get it right this time. Okay, I'd like to get into some the obsession with unemployment is probably a major cause of fluctuations in the aggregate level of economic activity. And that would be another important reason for not getting obsessed by unemployment. What I mean by that is that actions which the federal government takes in response to the unemployment rate, because it's, golly, look at that unemployment rate, seem to be, there's mounting evidence that they are primary causes of inflation and recession. Now, this is a new view. This is contrary to what was the conventional wisdom. You all have heard of John Maynard Keynes, although I find that most people pronounce his name Keynes. It is Keynes, K-E-Y-N-E-S, the British economist who in the 1930s published a book called The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. Now, what Keynes intended, what he really said, well, I ain't going to get into. What emerged from this revolution in economic thought, and it really was a revolution, because it stirred the stale frog pond of economics to its depths, as one guy put it in an obituary article for Keynes. What emerged from the general theory was a kind of a simple little view of an economy which says that you can have either inflationary gaps or recessionary gaps or just right. Now, when you have a recessionary gap, that means that the total level of spending intentions by households and businesses and government is not sufficient to persuade business firms to produce enough to employ everybody. You know, so aggregate demand is too low. And that leads to recession. And when aggregate demand is too high, when the intentions of consumers, investors, and government is to spend more money to spend money at such a rate that business firms can't produce enough goods to satisfy it, then that bids the price level up and you get inflation. That's basically what emerged as the Keynesian model. And it was taught in the textbooks. It got into the textbooks right after World War II. And you know, a funny thing happens in a discipline. When an idea gets into the textbooks and is taught to the introductory students, it acquires the status of irrefutable truth. It becomes a presupposition that it has an effect not just on students who know that what's in a textbook has got to be true. Trade books are questionable, but textbooks give us the solid facts of the science. You know. But it also has an effect on economists themselves. You know, growing up, and they were sophomores once. Then they go into graduate school and they work it all out, and they become imbued with it. It's a point of view. I can still remember it at the time when I was astonished once when somebody at a meeting I was at said that this model was absurd, and I just sneered at it, because I'd learned to see the world through it. Well, that model, suggested, carried a policy implication. If we got a recession, it's easy. All the government has to do is do something to stimulate spending. And if we're in an inflation, all the government has to do is do something to inhibit spending. If you bring aggregate demand to the right level, then we will have no recession and no inflation. And it's just lovely. The The argument through the 40s and 50s was not over then whether the government should do this, but which of two techniques it should use. One technique is the budget technique called fiscal policy. The government either increases its expenditures or decreases its expenditures or increases or decreases taxes. What it does basically is it adjusts the rate, the relationship between spending and taxes. If it wants to stimulate the economy, it increases spending relative to taxes, either by cutting taxes, raising spending, or some mixture. And that stimulates spending and brings the economy back to presumably full employment. The other technique was monetary policy, which is a little more difficult to understand, a little more abstruse, but it essentially involves the Federal Reserve System, which is the central bank, and it's under control of the federal government. It adjusts the total stock of currency and bank deposits in the hands of the public, with the intention thereby of stimulating either additional spending or less spending. Now, how that works, I don't bother with. But that was what the debate was about. In the 40s, most economists thought monetary policy was pretty ineffective, and fiscal policy was whiz-bang. Gradually, as a result of all kinds of experience and research, monetary policy began to grow in people's estimation, and fiscal policy began to recognize some of its limitations. But I don't want to get into the controversy between whether we should use fiscal policy or monetary policy, because that's not where the issue is today. The issue is whether we should use either one at all. That's where the debate is. Does the government, in reality, not in our models, but in the real world, have the ability to adjust aggregate demand to that level which would eliminate inflation and eliminate unemployment? I think that economists, like a lot of other people, have been badly victimized here by what I call the genie conception of government. The genie conception of government is this conception that many of us have, that if you've got a problem and you clearly recognize the problem and you all have your hearts in the right place and say, we will march forth now to solve this problem, then, you know, as long as our hearts are in the right place, government is like Aladdin's magic genie. We can now instruct it and it will solve the problem. That's not so. Government is not a genie. Government is individuals interacting in pursuit of their interests. And they are fallible individuals. The real problem, the key problem, you know, that thing is going to smoke if that door is open. Is there some? Could you close that door? Maybe that one. Somebody, Billy, could you? Will that?
I don't know how it's going to fix me.
Yeah, I don't understand. How this, there's a genie that, huh? Okay, is that it? Yeah, Paul's the expert on drafts around here. When he's not generating one.
I think that window is
it's flushing it up here, the side that are closer.
Must be a true way to do this.
Yeah.
We need a higher step.
You've got to have a balance.
Yeah. It is. Well, what you can do is back off from the fire. That's another way. See? Instead of adjusting the fire, adjust your position to it. The questions, here are the questions. I think as soon as you think about them, you realize, my golly, these are momentous questions. But there were questions that were almost totally ignored in the 40s, 50s, and well into the 60s, until the experience of the 1970s kind of hit us over the head. Here we had inflation plus recession, and economists were offering no effective counsel on what to do about it. The recommendation to the government, move aggregate demand to the appropriate level, presupposes, one, that government officials know where aggregate demand is right now. And they don't. Nobody knows where aggregate demand is. For one thing, we begin to get data on it more than a month after the fact. And during a month, a lot of things can change. And even then, the data are highly unreliable. 6 months after a quarter has ended, the Bureau of Economic Analysis publishes its final preliminary revision of the data. Well, I say final preliminary revision because it reserves the right within 3 years to make another revision. on the basis of more evidence coming. And recently, those buggers readjusted the data all the way back to 1946.
Ooh.
Made little revisions because they were clarifying the concept. Because they've been misled by some conceptual problems. If you want to see what the, well, no, I recommend the January issue of the Survey of Current, but January 1976, it's two big fat volumes. If you think the gross national product or these data on aggregate demand are hard numbers, like the things chemists have available to them, read that issue. Secondly, we don't know where aggregate demand is right now. What level is appropriate? What is the level of aggregate demand, that total spending that would end inflation or bring unemployment down to the appropriate level? We don't know. This isn't some kind of constant. There's not some constant functional relationship between aggregate demand and these other things we're interested in. Then, is any level at all appropriate? Or is a level consistent with full employment perhaps inconsistent with price stability? That's the alarming lesson that we've begun to learn in the 1970s. Then, what about the whole international economy? Again, that's something that has come with a shock to a lot of people who thought that the American economy, the domestic economy, was pretty isolated from the world economy. I could show you some numbers just take data on changes in the price level. You can take the price levels of the major industrial countries for any period from, say, 1950 to the present. And you will discover remarkable correlations in their price levels. Now, why? Every country has its own fiscal and monetary policy, its own trade unions, its own corporate price-setting practices, its own institutions. Countries are all very, very different. But they are interconnected. They are extraordinarily interconnected. We're just beginning to discover how interconnected they are. Money moves internationally, so that basically what happens is that if prices are a little bit more attractive in Belgium than they are in the United States, American money starts moving to Belgium. And that, of course, increases demand in Belgium and builds up the price level. So that in the kind of interdependent world economy that we now have, when one country has inflation, it transmits it rapidly to other countries. So the idea that our government can sit in Washington and manipulate the American economy is false, because our government doesn't have the power to control the other economies. The last thing that I would mention, as a kind of criticism with this, is the inattention economists have given to the fundamental problem of time lags. Even if we knew where aggregate demand is now and what the appropriate level is, and if we knew how to isolate our economy from foreign effects, and if there was some appropriate level, how long would it take between the action, let's say, of the tax cut and its final effects? And there is a time lag there. There are all kinds of time lags. And economists have been doing a lot of research on these time lags for both fiscal policy and monetary policy. And the conclusion which is beginning to emerge is that the time lags have no length. They are quite unpredictable. I'm not surprised at that. It seems to me the question of how long would it take for an increase in the money stock to have 65% of its effect on investment spending, for example, that question seems to me to be a lot like the question, how long would it take for the news to spread? What news? Spread where? To whom? Who has an interest in spreading it? What means are available for transmitting it? That question, what is the time lag of monetary policy? It's too broad a question. It depends very much upon the circumstances, all kinds of detailed circumstances. A colleague of mine has suggested that measuring time lags, too, is a bit like trying to measure the length of an angleworm that wiggles in response to your efforts to measure it. Because, you see, the problem with human beings, the problem with trying to determine what human beings do is, as soon as you determine it and let them know it, they find it in their interest to do something different. That's not a cynical observation. If the monetary experts were able to measure the precise distribution of the time lags from monetary policy, it would become in the financial interest of a lot of people with control of a lot of money to alter their behavior on the basis of that data about time lags. And that would alter the length of the timelines. So it's generally conceded today that the optimism which reigned in the 1960s, and I guess that the high watermark of the optimism was Walter Heller's crowning as economic master. Walter Heller was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under Kennedy, and then he was for Andrew Johnson too until he resigned. But he was the guy who steered through the big tax cut in 1964 on Keynesian grounds, on fine-tuning grounds. Heller was running, was not only advocating this before Congress and advocating it to the president, but he was also doing a lot of public education, urging people to believe that economists had the knowledge which would enable government to precisely adjust aggregate demand to secure full employment without inflation. He was the big seller of fine-tuning. He may even have invented the word. He's quite a wordsmith. His speeches and articles are full of metaphors. He's from Minnesota, too. He's Regius Professor of Economics at the University of Minnesota. And I'm always amused by him because I have had a little rule some years ago that says the amount of the reliability of an economist's essays or speeches is in inverse proportion to the number of metaphors per paragraph. And Heller, read Heller sometimes. He's gritty, inventive metaphors, full of them. You know what somebody says? The economy is steaming up a steep incline toward a new plateau. But the wheels are getting a little sand from care of this involved. In prison, you begin thinking the economy is just like a railroad train. But it isn't. Okay, it is now generally conceded, even by Heller. Heller has apologized in public for overselling the idea of fine-tuning. He was the president of the American Economics Association a couple of years ago and delivered a presidential address saying, our economists, sort of on the theme, are economists still worthwhile? And interestingly, most of his arguments on what made economists worthwhile were not drawn from the area in which he has specialized, which is the area of fine-tuning the economy. It's increasingly, in fact, argued by economists, although this is not, I wouldn't say in a majority view, that we may be better off to have no intervention in the economy by government at all than some intervention. In other words, we cannot fine-tune the economy. Almost all economists now agree on that. We just don't have the knowledge. But maybe we can't even gross-tune it, because it may well be that the sheer attempt on the part of the government to manipulate aggregate demand, plus the expectation that the government will make the attempt, actually destabilizes the economy. This is a very complex argument, but there are two basic reasons for it. One is that the sheer size of the government makes forecasting by private decision makers far more uncertain and difficult when the government decides to be an active partner. You know, it's a bit like, suppose you've got a football game, you've got 20 little boys, and they're playing football. Well, you can kind of predict, they're all about the same size. Now introduce one real big, fat, fast boy in there, and he's gonna throw all your predictions off. The way the game goes now is going to be so heavily dependent on his mood. You know, some of you guys, maybe you used to play touch or tackle football, and you had the one big guy come down who wanted to play, and you couldn't keep him out because he'd beat you up if you wouldn't let him play. You know, remember how he could dominate the game? He's just too big. He upsets the laws of statistics. If he decides to tackle, he brings everybody down. If he decides he's not going to be tackled, he scores a touchdown every time. Well, another metaphor. No, notice, he who uses metaphors is bamboozled in you. But a metaphor that I like to use is that of an elephant in a boat. If think of the government and its attempts to stabilize as a large elephant in a small rowboat. You see, it is conceptually possible that an elephant sitting in a small rowboat on a choppy sea could, by adroitly adjusting his rear end, stabilize that rowboat. But if I were in the rowboat, I would prefer that the elephant sit still.
Does that mean then that the rediscount rate remains stable?
Oh, what it means technically, not what is a non-interventionist policy, turns out to be a tricky question.
Yeah, I don't see how you could avoid doing something with it.
It gets to be tricky. I'll be happy to discuss that with I'm told that I can talk till 10:30, but that's the bell, and those of you who are hungrier for food than for knowledge.
No, you can't, please. I would do. I've got a couple more things that I must say. The other reason why, the other main reason why many economists are now arguing that any attempt to intervene may do more harm than good is simply the political pressures, the nature of the particular political pressures that influence the Federal Reserve Board and the Congress. That you might think about the implications of this, that fiscal and monetary policies do have a rather long-range effect. In other words, they don't really have their effect for a period, maybe monetary policy. Now, people use the figure 15 months. In other words, if the Federal Reserve System increases the rate of growth in the money stock this month from 4% to 6%, that'll have the bulk of its effects about 1 year and 3 months from now. Okay, if the government has a policy instrument whose effects are that far off in the future, and if the government's political time horizon is the next election, it is highly likely that political pressures impinging on legislators are going to cause them to do things that satisfy those pressures and leave the consequences to their successors. In other words, if there's a high unemployment rate and the unions are saying, get that unemployment rate down, and maybe the legislators know, well, we can't get it down, but we sure can seem to be getting it down, by doing so, we will cause big problems 2 years from now, but if we don't do something now, we won't even be in Congress 2 years from now. That, in short, is the sort of the reason why it may be politically dangerous to practice, to use intervention policy. I want to say something about the Phillips curve now. There's another notion that has been exploded by the experience of the 70s. Back in 1958, a British economist named A.W. Phillips published an article on the historical relationship between wage rates and employment levels in Great Britain. And what he showed was that when employment levels were very high, in other words, when unemployment levels were low, wage rates tended to rise rather rapidly. And when unemployment levels were rather high, wage rates did not rise rapidly or even fell. Well, I'm not surprised about that at all. I don't think it's a startling conclusion. When employment is high, employers are hunting for workers and having trouble finding them. They tend to bid wage rates up. But several years later, Paul Samuelson and a colleague of his at Massachusetts Institute of Technology published a little article in which they tried to extend this argument. They said, hey, you know what? It may well be that inflation... they shifted from wage rates to prices. It's okay. It may be that inflation and unemployment are alternatives. That you can't have price stability and full employment. You got to choose one or the other. And they constructed a hypothetical, what they then called Phillips curve, with respect to A.W. Phillips, a hypothetical Phillips curve, which showed what they called a menu of choices confronted in society. It was a curve that looked something like this. Samuelson said, don't pay any attention to what the empirical shape of the curve, I got it by just putting a thread down on a bunch of dots. But if you put the percentage change per year in the price level, the consumer price index on this axis, and of course that can be negative, prices could go down. And on this axis, you put the percentage unemployment, that total unemployed as a percentage of the civilian labor force, what you're going to find is that you can't get, let's say we say 3% is enough. That's what we want. 3% is full employment. And 3% of the civilian labor force is unemployed. You can't get to this spot. Ain't no way. Your menu of choices may be something like that. So that if you want, let's say, 3% unemployment, you may have to accept 8% per year inflation. And I'm just making these numbers up. And if you say, oh golly, we want zero, we want price stability, you may have to accept 8% unemployment. Now, that is the idea of the Phillips curve. And what it suggests, of course, is that we got to choose inflation or unemployment. And of course, it encourages people to believe then that he who is tolerant of unemployment is doing so because he can't stand inflation. And if you won't do anything about unemployment, it's because you're just determined to stop inflation. Well, the 1970s really blasted that, as we had rapid inflation with very high levels of unemployment. In fact, the argument, there is no good theoretical argument behind it.
You're bothering me because you're comparing two different errors
One of the things is that we had a lot of social programs going in this at this time, which cushioned all of these.
I don't want to get into all that. No, there's what I want to just say, and want to say quick is that there's no. Well, Jack, what I want to point out is that there is no good reason for suspecting that there is a Phillips curve, that there is this kind of trade-off, because it's the reason that. Let me put it this way. There's a fundamental fallacy of assuming that correlation implies causation. It is true that when the economy is operating close to full employment, prices and wages are going to tend to get bid up. But if you, metaphor coming, if you will notice that when there's a big crowd at the basketball game, the gymnasium is very hot. Suppose then that the ticket manager decides to increase proceeds by heating up the gymnasium when the basketball team has a losing record. That's really what is being recommended. You see, it is true that a high level of employment does tend to lead to forces that bid up the price level. But you cannot, by bidding up the price level, get a high level of employment. The causal relationship runs the other way. And that is, I think, pretty generally conceded now. But it means that we don't have a choice between employment, unemployment, and inflation, except for a very short period of time. It is possible temporarily to bring down the unemployment rate by deliberately causing inflation for this reason, that people are misled, that people think, workers think they're getting good deals, and so they take jobs in the belief that the wage rate is more attractive than it really is. You know, the money wage rate has gone up, but the real wage rate hasn't gone up because prices have gone up too. But we have to pay the cost of that. Then what happens is that when you, eventually they catch on and the employment rate goes back down, and then you try to stop the inflation, and what happens is that businessmen are now expecting to sell their goods at high prices, and the public won't pay those high prices anymore, and so now inventories begin to pile up and you get a recession.
I think your problem is that you've got a problem with the dynamic here, and you've got a time constant, and you don't want to recognize this. And if this is true, if you talk about a certain time constant, if you talk about a longer one, it's not true. And in a sense, that's what you're saying, but in a sense, you can't ignore this effect here.
You can't ignore this effect.
Because the system is not a stable system and never will be. It's dynamically oriented, and it's going to continually change. And therefore, the example you gave in dynamics, you're talking about putting an external force on or an internal force, and they have different reactions on the things, and you can't compare. You're trying to compare apples and oranges if you're not careful here. And this statement, as I see it, is true over a certain time spectrum. And I think you agree with
it. It is. I think this is true for a very, very short period.
Yeah. But
what happens
in that next period of time, you've also got another dynamic situation, which may be.
What happens is, if you're interested in 2 months from now or the coming election, you've got a menu like that. But as soon as you eat from that menu, the curve shifts like this.
Yeah. Okay.
And then you're caught. In other words, what happens is you got. You're, say, out here somewhere, too high a level of unemployment. So you want to get your unemployment level down to here, you accept this rate of inflation.
Yeah.
What happens is, I didn't ship this before, you slide up here, but then you slide back out here. So the path is, you get lower unemployment with inflation, and then the old level of unemployment is restored. And then if you try to slow down the rate of inflation, the level of employment climbs even higher.
But just don't throw this out. It's just part of a rather complex problem here that you're saying is that there's a time scale where this fits, and then there's a time when it's no longer useful and then something else goes into it. But it's not that it isn't true over a certain over time. I think.
Let me say because it's now 10:30. I got one more session here, and what I want to get into is something that I think this raises the question of power in the American economy. Power and the distribution of income and wealth, those are connected. And what I would have slid into if I'd had more time here is the argument of increasing number of people that the reason fiscal and monetary policy don't work and the reason that we don't have a favorable Phillips curve is because some people have too much economic power. And economists have often been accused of ignoring the problems of power and the belief that somehow there was a competitive market out there in which everybody behaved like a wheat farmer. That is, a wheat farmer without who doesn't write his congressman. And so I want to get into that next time. Okay, so those of you who've been nice, or no, you can all leave now, but if you want to stay and talk, I'm not hungry.